A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's asking about incense in Jewish tradition. The temple service had this elaborate incense ritual, Kidaret, with a specific recipe, and it was a huge deal. But today, incense is basically absent from Jewish practice, and most Jews associate it with other religions entirely. He wants to know the history and how that reversal happened.
This is one of those topics where the popular understanding is almost perfectly backwards. Most people assume incense was always a pagan borrowing that Judaism eventually outgrew. The reality is that for roughly 1,000 years, from the tabernacle in the wilderness through both temples, incense was as central to Israelite worship as animal sacrifice. Possibly more central, in some ways.
It wasn't just ambient fragrance. This was a core ritual.
It was the core ritual in certain respects. The Kidaret was offered twice daily on the golden altar that stood in the holy place just outside the Holy of Holies. And once a year, on Yom Kippur, the high priest brought a pan of burning coals and incense directly into the Holy of Holies itself. That was the only time anyone entered that space. The Talmud describes the moment as absolutely terrifying. If the high priest deviated from the recipe or had improper intentions, he would die right there.
High-stakes aromatherapy.
More like high-stakes theology. The recipe is specified in Exodus chapter 30, 4 ingredients, but the Talmud in Keratot 6a breaks it down into 11 spices. You've got stacta, which is probably a myrrh derivative, onycha, galbanum, frankincense, plus 7 others including saffron and cinnamon. The total was 368 manet, which works out to something like 360 pounds of spices per year. A massive operation.
One of those ingredients famously smells terrible.
It's a resin from a Persian plant, Ferula galbaniflua, and on its own it smells acrid, almost unpleasant. The rabbis explicitly noted that it was included despite its odor, and they read this as a lesson about community, that even sinners must be included in the congregation. The incense wasn't complete without the difficult ingredient.
That's a remarkably sophisticated read for a spice blend. The unpleasant one stays in the mix as a theological principle.
It gets better. The Talmud in Yoma 20b says the smoke from the Kidaret would rise in a straight column, like a palm tree, and when it hit the ceiling of the holy place, it would spread out and descend, filling the entire space. The fragrance was said to carry all the way to Jericho, roughly 15 miles away. During the 3 pilgrimage festivals, when massive crowds were at Jerusalem, they wouldn't need to say, "The incense is being offered now." You could smell it.
Jericho is not close. That's a claim about potency.
It's a claim about something more than potency, I think. The rabbis are describing an experience that was sensorily overwhelming. The scent wasn't just a background note. It was the signal that God was present and being served. In the ancient Near East, fragrance was how you knew a deity was in residence. Egyptian temples, Mesopotamian ziggurats, Canaanite high places, they all burned incense. The smell of a temple was the smell of the god.
Israel wasn't doing something unique. They were participating in a regional vocabulary.
And that's the first thing most people get wrong. They assume the incense was a distinctively Israelite invention that later got corrupted by foreign influence. But the practice was already widespread. What made Israelite incense distinctive was the exclusive location, only in the tabernacle or temple, only by authorized priests, and the specific recipe, which was forbidden for any other use. Exodus chapter 30, verses 37 and 38 are explicit. Anyone who replicates the Kidaret formula for personal use shall be cut off from his people.
That's a death penalty for DIY air freshener.
The prohibition was taken seriously. There's a fascinating episode in the Mishnah, in Yoma chapter 3, where the house of Avtinas, the family guild responsible for compounding the incense, refused to teach anyone else the secret of how they prepared the onycha, which apparently involved a specific processing technique. The temple authorities brought in perfumers from Alexandria to try to replicate it, and they couldn't get the smoke to rise in that straight column,
Wait, the column thing was reproducible? It wasn't just a miracle story?
The sources are ambiguous. Some read it as miraculous, but the Avtinas family clearly had a proprietary technique that produced a specific physical effect. They were so protective of it that the sages eventually fired them. They brought in replacements. The replacements couldn't produce the same result, so the sages had to go crawling back to Avtinas, who then doubled their price.
The first recorded case of vendor lock-in.
In the temple incense supply chain, the Avtinas family held a monopoly they could enforce because they had what we'd now call trade secrets. And the sages were furious about it, but couldn't do anything. The Mishnah records their justification. The family claimed they had a tradition that the temple would be destroyed, and they didn't want the sacred technique falling into unworthy hands.
Which turned out to be prescient.
In a tragic way, yes. The second temple was destroyed in 70 CE. And that's the pivot point. The incense ritual was tethered entirely to the temple. No temple, no altar, no altar, no incense. When the Romans leveled Jerusalem, the entire sacrificial system, including the Kitaret, ceased overnight, and it has never been restored.
The absence isn't because Judaism evolved past it. It's because the ritual was location-locked, and the location was destroyed.
And this is where the story gets really interesting, because the rabbis of the Talmud had to figure out what Judaism looks like without a temple. They replace sacrifice with prayer. The Amidah is explicitly structured as a substitute for the daily offerings. But incense presented a specific problem. It wasn't just a sacrifice you could verbalize. It was a sensory experience. You can't pray a smell.
You can describe it, though.
That's exactly what they did. The Talmud in Barakot and in Yoma preserves incredibly detailed descriptions of the incense ritual. The rabbis taught that studying the laws of the incense was a substitute for actually offering it. To this day, traditional prayer books include a section called Pidum HaKetoret, the compounding of the incense, which is recited daily in the morning service. It's a word-for-word recitation of the recipe and procedure from the Talmud.
The incense didn't disappear. It got textualized.
Exactly the right word. It became a text to study rather than a substance to burn. And that shift had enormous downstream consequences. Because once the ritual was only a memory and a text, the actual practice of burning incense in a Jewish context became, there was no prohibition against it exactly, but there was no framework for it either. It wasn't part of the synagogue service. The synagogue was modeled on the temple courts, the reading of Torah, the prayers, the priestly blessing. But the incense altar was inside the holy place, not in the courtyard where the people gathered. So it had no architectural or liturgical parallel in the synagogue.
The physical space of the synagogue didn't accommodate it.
Over time, that absence became normative. By the early medieval period, you start seeing rabbinic authorities explicitly discouraging the use of incense in Jewish contexts. Not because incense is inherently wrong, but because it had become associated with other religions.
That's the second reversal. First, it disappears physically. Then it gets redefined as foreign.
The timing matters. Christianity had adopted incense into its liturgy very early. By the 4th century, you've got censers swinging in churches across the Byzantine Empire. The imagery of incense appears throughout the Book of Revelation, which draws heavily on temple imagery. So for Jews living in Christian-majority lands, incense was something you encountered in churches. It smelled like the dominant religion.
That's awkward when the dominant religion is not always friendly.
To put it mildly, the association hardened over centuries. By the time of the Crusades, the scent of incense was literally the scent of the persecuting power. And then Islam adds another layer. Incense is widely used in Islamic contexts, especially in the form of bakur, the wood chips soaked in perfumed oils that are burned in homes and mosques. For Jews living in Muslim-majority lands, incense was everywhere, but always in someone else's sacred space.
The smell that once announced, "God is here among us," became the smell that announced, "You are the minority."
That's the tragedy of it. There's a phrase from the Zohar that I think about. The Zohar describes the Kitaret as the most beloved of all offerings, the one that binds the divine attributes together. It uses the language of chains and knots. And that most beloved ritual became, through historical circumstance, a marker of exclusion.
There's something almost unbearably sad about that. A scent that was supposed to unify becomes a dividing line.
Yet the textual tradition preserved it in extraordinary detail. The Pitam Hakatorit isn't just a memory, it's an anticipation. The traditional text ends with a statement that anyone who recites the incense formula properly will be considered as if they actually offered it, and then quotes Exodus, "And the incense which you shall make, you shall not make for yourselves." The prohibition is still live. The recipe is still known. The restoration is still theoretically possible.
Is anyone actually trying to recreate it?
There are a few groups. The Temple Institute in Jerusalem has been reconstructing temple vessels and priestly garments for decades. They've produced a version of the Kidaret based on their best understanding of the ancient ingredients. But there are real problems. Several of the ingredients are disputed. We genuinely don't know what Anika was. The Talmud describes it as a substance derived from a plant, but other sources suggest it might be a mollusk operculum, which would make it not kosher. That's a whole debate.
That would be a problem for temple use.
And the Rambam, Maimonides, in his Mishneh Torah, Hilchot Clay, Hamikdash, Chapter 2, seems to lean toward the plant identification, but it's not settled. Then there's the issue of the smoke column. The Avtinas technique is lost. We don't know what they did to the Anika to make the smoke behave that way. Some researchers have speculated it involved an alkali treatment, essentially soap-making chemistry, that would alter the combustion properties.
Even if you wanted to restart the ritual tomorrow, you'd have a supply chain problem and a lost technology problem.
A political problem. The site of the temple is currently occupied by the Dome of the Rock and Al-Aqsa Mosque. The idea of rebuilding the temple is not a fringe position in certain Jewish circles, but it's also not something anyone is about to do tomorrow. The incense question is, in practice, entangled with the most sensitive geopolitical issues on the planet.
Which explains why most Jewish communities have simply, the incense is a memory, a text, a metaphor, not a practice.
There's a fascinating sociological layer here. In the late 20th century, you started seeing a small revival of incense use in some Jewish contexts. Not the Kidaret, nobody's burning that, but Havdalah spices, Besamim. The Havdalah ceremony at the end of Shabbat includes a blessing over fragrant spices, and that's the one surviving liturgical use of fragrance in mainstream Judaism. You smell the spices, you mark the transition from sacred time back to ordinary time.
That survived because it was domestic, not temple-bound.
It was never centralized. Every family did it at home, so when the temple fell, Havdalah just kept going. But here's the interesting thing. In recent decades, some Jewish communities have started experimenting with incense beyond Havdalah. Jewish renewal congregations, some Neo-Hasidic groups, even some modern Orthodox communities have brought back the use of incense for meditation, for study, for creating sacred atmosphere. It's still marginal, but it's growing.
What's the pushback?
The pushback is exactly what the prompt identified. It feels non-Jewish. People walk into a Jewish space that smells of incense, and their instinct is, this is a church, or this is a Buddhist meditation hall. The association is so deeply ingrained that even people who know the history find it viscerally strange.
Which is a remarkable example of how sensory associations can override intellectual knowledge. You can know that incense was Jewish for 1,000 years, and still feel like it doesn't belong.
There's a famous story about the Vilna Gaon, the great 18th century Lithuanian rabbi who was once asked why Jews don't use incense in synagogues given its temple origins. And he reportedly answered that in exile, the sense of smell is in a diminished state. He tied it to a midrash that says when the temple was destroyed, the sense of smell lost its full spiritual capacity.
That's a deeply poignant idea. That exile isn't just geographical, it's sensory. We literally can't smell holiness the way we used to.
That midrash isn't just a throwaway line. It connects to a broader rabbinic anthropology of the senses. The rabbis ranked the senses, and smell was uniquely associated with the soul. The Talmud in Berakot 43b says that smell is the sense from which the soul benefits, not the body. Taste, touch, sight, hearing, those are bodily. Smell is spiritual.
Which would make the absence of incense in exile a kind of sensory amputation. The soul's sense is offline.
That's why the textual substitute matters so much. The Pitam Hakatorit isn't just information. When you recite it, you're supposed to visualize the ritual to reconstruct it in your mind. The rabbis are essentially doing what we'd now call guided visualization. They're trying to keep the neural pathways alive even though the sensory input is gone.
The incense ritual became a meditation practice.
That's exactly what it became. And in some Hasidic traditions, the recitation of Pitum HaKetoret is treated as a particularly powerful spiritual practice. You're supposed to recite it slowly, with intense concentration, imagining each ingredient, each step of the compounding, each movement of the priest. It's a form of mental pilgrimage.
Which brings us to the other part of the prompt, how incense became associated with other religions. We've touched on Christianity and Islam, but there's also the broader New Age and Eastern context.
In the 1960s and 70s, incense became a countercultural signifier in the West. It was associated with Indian spirituality, with Buddhism, with hippie culture, Nag Champa, and patchouli. For Jews of that generation, incense wasn't just church, it was also the ashram. And that added another layer of foreignness.
Even though, ironically, the Indian use of incense has its own ancient history that runs parallel to the Israelite one. The Vedas describe incense offerings. The Buddhists brought incense along the Silk Road. Everyone was burning things.
Incense is arguably one of the oldest continuous human religious practices, period. The earliest archaeological evidence of incense use goes back to the 5th millennium BCE in the Arabian Peninsula, where resin from the boswellia tree, frankincense, was being burned. By the time the Israelites are building the tabernacle, incense has already been a human practice for 3,000 years.
The Kidaret is actually a latecomer in the global history of incense.
Yes, but it's distinctive in its theological framing. In many ancient cultures, incense was offered to feed the gods. The smoke was literally divine food. In the Israelite system, that's explicitly not the case. The sacrifices are called resh nikwash, a pleasing aroma, but the pleasure is not about divine consumption. The incense is a signal, a communication, a form of approach. It's relational rather than nutritional.
That's a significant theological refinement. This isn't dinner for God. This is a message.
That's why the recipe was so strictly controlled. If the incense is a message, the content matters. You can't just burn whatever you want and call it communication. The specific ingredients, the specific proportions, the specific timing, all of it is the vocabulary of the message.
Which makes the Aftina's family's trade secrets even more interesting. They were guarding the syntax of divine communication.
Charging a premium for it, which the rabbis found deeply distasteful. The Mishnah and Yoma records that the Aftina's family was criticized for their greed, for refusing to teach, and for one more thing, their brides never wore perfume. They explained this as a precaution. They didn't want anyone to suspect they were using the sacred ingredients for personal purposes. But the rabbis saw it as a kind of performative piety.
We're so holy, our wives can't smell nice. That does sound like the kind of thing that would irritate practical-minded sages.
The rabbis of the Mishnah were not fans of performative stringency. They preferred clear rules applied equally. The Aptina's family's mystique rubbed them the wrong way, even though they had to tolerate it, because the family controlled an essential technology.
What can we actually say about what the Kidaret smelled like? Do we have any idea?
We can make educated guesses. Frankincense is the dominant note. It's a resin from boswellia trees, and when burned, it produces a sweet, citrusy, slightly piney aroma. Myrrh, which is likely the stack day, is warmer and more bitter. Cinnamon and saffron would add spice and depth. The galbanum, as we mentioned, is acrid and green. It would cut the sweetness. The overall profile was probably complex, layered, not just nice. It wasn't a simple, pleasant fragrance. It was meant to be striking, even challenging.
A scent that makes you pay attention, not one that makes you relax.
Which fits the context. You're a priest entering the holy place. The golden altar is in front of you. The veil to the Holy of Holies is right there. The smell hits you, and it's not like anything you encounter in daily life. It's otherworldly. It signals that you have crossed a boundary.
Now, for 2,000 years, nobody has smelled it.
That absence is itself a kind of presence. The missing scent is part of Jewish consciousness. Every day in traditional prayer, you recite the recipe. You remind yourself of what was lost. The incense is gone, but its description is preserved in exquisite detail. It's an ongoing act of collective memory.
There's something very Jewish about that. The thing itself is gone, but the text about the thing is alive.
The text is generative. It produces commentary, debate, imagination. We're still arguing about what onika was. We're still trying to reconstruct the Avtina's technique. The absence generates discourse.
Which is arguably the whole rabbinic project in miniature. The temple is gone, so we study the temple. The sacrifices are gone, so we study the sacrifices. The incense is gone, so we study the incense. The text replaces the thing, and then the text becomes a thing in itself.
That move, from practice to text, is what allowed Judaism to survive the destruction of its central institution. Most ancient religions didn't survive the loss of their temple. When the temple went, the religion went. Judaism survived because the rabbis had already built a textual infrastructure that could function without a geographic center.
The disappearance of incense isn't a bug. It's a feature of the system that enabled survival.
I think that's right. But it's also a loss. The rabbis themselves mourned it. There's a famous passage in the Talmud, in Sota 48a, that lists things that were lost when the temple was destroyed. Among them, the taste of fruits, the sweetness of honey, the sound of the Sanhedrin's deliberations. The world became dimmer. The incense was part of a sensorily rich religious world that exile flattened into text.
Now there's this small but real movement to bring some of that sensory richness back. You mentioned Havdalah spices, Jewish renewal incense use. Is there any push to actually restore the Ketoret?
Only among groups actively preparing for a rebuilt temple. The Temple Institute has a formulated Ketoret that they display. But for mainstream Judaism, the Ketoret is firmly in the category of when the Messiah comes. It's not something you experiment with. The prohibition in Exodus is still understood as binding. You don't make this formula for yourself, period.
Even though nobody's quite sure what the formula is.
The uncertainty doesn't create permission. If anything, it reinforces the prohibition. The fact that we can't be sure we have the right ingredients means any attempt would be presumptuous at best, sacrilegious at worst. Better to wait.
The incense sits in this strange limbo. It's central to the tradition, meticulously described, daily recited, and completely inaccessible. A fragrance trapped in text.
That's the answer to the prompt's question. How did incense go from central to absent, from Jewish to feeling foreign? It was location locked to a building that was destroyed. Christianity and Islam adopted it and made it their own. The rabbis replaced it with text. And over two millennia, the sensory memory faded until the smell of incense in a religious context triggered associations with everyone except the tradition that once made it the centerpiece of divine service.
The irony being that when a Jew today walks into a church and smells incense, they're encountering a practice that Christianity borrowed from the temple tradition. It's not foreign. It's a loan that was never returned.
Christianity added its own theological layers. In the Eastern Orthodox tradition, the incense represents the prayers of the saints rising to heaven, which is actually a direct quotation from the book of Revelation, which is itself quoting Psalm 141, "Let my prayer be set forth as incense before you." The chain of transmission is right there in the text.
The imagery is continuous, even if the practice isn't.
That's what makes the whole thing so fascinating. The incense didn't really disappear. Part of it went into Christian liturgy. Part of it went into Islamic sensory culture. Part of it went into Jewish textual study. And part of it survived in the domestic Havdalah ritual. The Ketoret was shattered and the pieces scattered.
Which is a pretty good metaphor for a lot of Jewish history.
The dispersion of a practice mirroring the dispersion of a people. I don't think that's an accident. The rabbis who shaped post-temple Judaism were deeply aware that they were managing fragmentation. They preserved what they could, textualized what they had to, and accepted that some things would be lost until a messianic restoration.
Do you think the current small revival of incense in some Jewish circles represents something new? Or is it just a blip?
I think it's genuine, but limited. There's a broader trend in contemporary Judaism toward recovering embodied practices, things you do with your body, not just with your mind. Meditation, chanting, ritual immersion, pilgrimage. Incense fits into that. But it's also fighting 2,000 years of absence and a very strong cultural association that says incense equals not us.
The nose has a long memory.
A conservative one. Smell is the sense most directly wired to memory and emotion. The olfactory bulb connects straight to the amygdala and hippocampus. It doesn't go through the thalamus first like the other senses. So scent associations are formed fast and they're very hard to overwrite. If you grew up smelling incense only in churches, that wiring is deep.
Even if you intellectually know the history, Your limbic system is saying, we are in a church right now.
And that's not something you could reason your way out of. It's a genuine barrier to the reintroduction of incense in Jewish practice. The body remembers what the mind might wish it didn't.
Which brings us back to the galbanum, the unpleasant ingredient that had to be included for the offering to be complete. Maybe the discomfort some Jews feel about incense is itself a kind of galbanum, the thing that doesn't fit, that smells wrong, but that belongs in the mix.
That's a beautiful read. The rabbi said the incense wasn't complete without the galbanum. Maybe the Jewish relationship with incense isn't complete without the tension, the strangeness, the sense that this doesn't quite belong. That discomfort is part of the story.
The Kidaret is a scent that includes its own alienation.
If you think about it, that's actually a very sophisticated theological position. The divine presence is not only in the pleasant things, it's also in the acrid, the difficult, the estranged. The incense that rose in a straight column contained both the frankincense and the galbanum, the sweet and the sharp, the familiar and the foreign.
Which maybe means that a Jew today who walks into a space that smells of incense and feels that twinge of this doesn't belong here is actually having an authentically Kidaret-like experience. The tension is the point.
I don't know if that's comforting, but it's certainly interesting.
Most interesting things aren't comforting.
And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1950s, Soviet-backed researchers in Mongolia attempted to weaponize cuttlefish camouflage by breeding cephalopods that could mimic military insignia, only to discover the cuttlefish would exclusively display the logo of a local fermented mare's milk cooperative, rendering the entire project an unintended advertisement for Arug.
Of course they did. Here's the question I'm left with. The Kidaret recipe is preserved. The textual tradition is alive. The association with foreign religions is strong, but historically contingent. If the temple were rebuilt tomorrow, and I know that's a huge if, would the incense just... would it feel like a restoration, or would it feel like a new thing pretending to be old?
I think it would feel profoundly strange. 2,000 years is a long time for a practice to be dormant. The first time that smoke rose in a straight column, assuming anyone could even reproduce it, it would be utterly unfamiliar. Nobody alive has ever experienced it. The ritual would be ancient and brand new at the same time.
Which is maybe the only way a messianic restoration could actually feel. If it were just familiar, it wouldn't be transformative.
That's the paradox at the heart of this whole topic. The incense is simultaneously the most beloved offering and the most alien one. It's central to the tradition and completely absent from it. It's described in minute detail and completely unknown. It's the scent of home that nobody has ever smelled.
Somewhere in that paradox is the whole story of Jewish continuity. The thing that was lost, preserved as text, and held in trust for a future that may or may not arrive.
In the meantime, we recite the recipe every morning, just in case.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumintop. You can find every episode at myweirdprompts.com.
If you enjoyed this, leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts.
Until next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.